Okay, Buddhism in modern times. It's a marvelous thing to have a Buddhist religion in these days, simply because that it seems that most people have a choice between materialism, where they just look at wealth, but their happiness, and sometimes it's the fundamentalist religions, which seem to say, please believe in this is the only alternative. What I've noticed in our modern times, there is an alternative between those two extremes, of like blind belief, but also just no belief at all. And I think that is actually what Buddhism in our modern world can actually give to people. Because Buddhism gives a rational teaching, something which you can test out for yourself. But it's also something which actually gets to your heart, which inspires you and encourages you to lead a good life. Not simply because you want to go to heaven in a future existence, but so you can go to heaven right now. Because this is what Buddhism really means. It brings these teachings down to earth to inspire and lead us. People do need something to guide them in our life. And that's why that sometimes that we give talks about Buddhism which relate to what you experience in everyday existence. One of the first talks which I gave at the Zen conference was called Buddha in the Office. And I gave that talk because many of you spend half your life in an office. And how can we bring spirituality into such an environment? You can, and it's wonderful when you do. Because usually what happens when you get a job, you have what we call the four spirations. The four spirations, you start with aspiration. Then you get inspiration. That's followed by desperation. And lastly, expiration as you leave. There's four aspirations. And unfortunately, that's what happens in many of our lives. We aspire, what's the other one? Inspiration, you get aspire, you inspire, which is a nice part, but then you desperation and expiration, which is when it's not very pleasant. So why is it, even in an office, we have all that suffering and problems? If we can bring religion or Buddhism into an office, we will know that it's worthwhile if it actually makes our office a kinder, better place. You know, in 3 or 4 months' time, I've been invited again to Singapore to give a conference, to teach at a conference which is not organized by the Buddhist Fellowship. It's the International Human Resources Conference, which is going to be in Singapore in May, the end of May. They're going to have HR professionals coming from around the world, and you're going to have a Buddhist monk, me, telling them how to run their business. And sometimes you may think, what is a Buddhist monk doing at a HR conference? And why is a monk like me invited? It is because the spiritual life, Buddhism in our modern times, actually helps increase your company's profits. And it does that simply because we need harmony. We need a way to solve these problems, not to waste time. We need to give our business the competitive edge to survive in this cutthroat world. And the Buddhist principles, now things like calming the mind in meditation, being honest, keeping precepts, working hard, being mindful, which means being right there in every minute to make sure that you do your job well, that you're listening to your customers, your clients. All those things enhance your ability to succeed in this world. Buddhism in the modern world is not just going off to a monastery and being a monk. Buddhism in this modern world means being a wife who can keep her husband on the straight and narrow. Being a husband who can be caring and sensitive to his wife. Being a parent who knows how to look after children. Being a child who can respect their parents. Being someone who's successful in all aspects of their life. Which is why that Buddhism in our modern life is about all of those things enhancing one's quality of life. And basically, I tell people, whether it's in Australia or Singapore or other places, if you come to a talk like this and you don't go away a happier, wiser, more compassionate person, then you can come up to me and ask for your money back. Because the spirituality, religion or Buddhism, whatever you call it, if it doesn't bring happiness, peace, guidance to your life, what's the point? Today was at a Zen conference. This is one of my favorite Zen stories. Of a man who wanted to cut through philosophy. He wanted to know whether there really was life after death. Was there really heaven and hell? And so he asked many, many people, could never get a straight answer. Because if I told you, Ajahn Brahm says, yes, there is a heaven, yes, there is a hell. So what? That's just Ajahn Brahm. Would you believe me? How do you know? Maybe I'm lying, or more likely that maybe I'm being deceived. So how can you find out for yourself? And so this one occasion, this man who was seeking the answer for many people, he was actually a samurai warrior. And eventually he found a monk, an old monk. And he asked that monk, said, monk, is there really heaven or hell after you die? And the monk looked at him and said, you're too stupid for me to give you an answer. He abused and scolded the samurai. And the samurai said, monk, I am not stupid. I am a samurai warrior. To become a samurai, you have to train for many years. Not just physically, but mentally as well. I am very knowledgeable. Do not call me stupid. The monk looked up at him with one eye and said, you, a samurai warrior, they'd never let someone of your type become a samurai. And the warrior, the soldier, started to get angry. Don't talk to me like that, as he grabbed his sword, or I'll cut your head off with my sword. Cut your head off with that rusty old blade. You couldn't even cut a slice of bread with that. And the samurai got out his sword and went to slice off the monk's head. But just at the last minute, the monk looked up and said, samurai, that is hell. His experience of hatred about to kill someone in that moment is what we call hell. And the warrior understood the meaning of the monk. Hell is not some place. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but certainly you can experience hell right in this moment, in this very life. Whenever you get angry, whenever you're really upset, that is hell. And that is the teaching of Buddhism, of all traditions, because it shows you that hell is something you can experience here and now. Every time you're upset, angry, afraid, despairing, you are in hell. The samurai understood. It was a direct teaching which didn't need to be proved by some scriptures or argued. It was something you can see right in this moment, here and now, from your experience. So he bowed down and said, thank you, O great master. At last I've heard someone who can speak some sense, who don't just say, believe what I say, but has actually showed me the truth of what hell is really like. Thank you, he said. And as he bowed to the monk and said thank you, that was when the monk said, and now please know that this is heaven. How you feel now is heaven. So he's teaching him heaven and hell. But I often comment, that was a very fortunate monk. I would not try that myself. You're liable to lose your head more times than you're going to teach somebody. But it showed an important part about Buddhism in our modern world. Because in our modern world, people are not just going to believe just because some authority figure says so. In many places that we are aspiring towards a more democratic society, and by that I mean everybody wants autonomy. They want to decide for themselves who they marry. The children want to decide what subject they will do at school. We want to decide our career or where we come and go. In the same way, people decide for themselves their religion or their spiritual path. It is a freedom of choice which is spreading through our world. And so each one of us in modern countries, and Singapore is such a country, will actually be faced, what spiritual life should we choose? It's called the marketplace of religions. Somebody asked me as I was coming in here, should I be a Buddhist or should I be a Christian? I'm trying to make up my mind. What should I do? And so I told them how I became a Buddhist. I said when I was 16, I too wanted a religion in life. I realized that religion is important. I needed guidance. And so what I did as a rational person, I went to the bookshop. And I got a book on Islam. I got a book on Buddhism. I got a book on Hinduism. I got a book on Christianity. I did research. In the same way, if you're going to choose a car, you actually research it first of all to see which particular car you really need. And also which one you can afford. Fortunately, Buddhism, you didn't have to pay any tithes to the church. It was very cheap. But it was the cheapest, and I thought the cheapest and the best. Actually, these days I say you don't have to pay to come into a Buddhist temple. This is one of the stories in my book. Because sometimes people expect to pay. And if they don't pay, they think there's no worth to it. Because once a lady rang up one of our monks and said, I hear you teach meditation. And he said, yes, madam, I do. She said, how much do you charge? He said, nothing, it's free. She said, well, you can't be any good then, and hung up the phone. So these days we don't do that. These days we say our teachings are priceless. So what that means, in our society sometimes we need to say things like that because people think that, my goodness, if you don't pay for it, it can't be worth very much at all. And I've seen this, I've seen that some of these people come from the United States. I could do this for myself. All I need to do is to put on a wig and wear a sharp suit. And I could be charging you $1,000 a head to come in here. And people pay. Why do they do that? And why do Buddhists not do that? You know why Buddhists don't do that? It's because there's something which doesn't connect between religion and money. And this is one thing which my teacher told me. He said, look, wherever you go, don't ask for anything. Don't ask for funds. Don't ask for food. Don't ask for anything. Just give. And that's why for my whole life, you know, I've just always given, done things for people, never expecting anything back in return. And that's why my monastery has grown so much. Simply because when you actually give, you're reaching people's hearts. You're not making commerce with religion. You're putting it one step above that. And then what happens is people think, wow, this is really good, this is very beautiful, I want to support. And then you find when they do make generous donations, it's even more generous than if they actually were asked to give. Have you ever noticed those who are volunteers here? You can work much harder if it's for a charity, if you're not being paid, than if it was your job. I've noticed that in Australia when people come and help at the temple, they work so much more harder than if we paid them. The reason is because they're doing it not for money, they're doing it for love, for kindness. You get more energy that way. So religion should not just be teaching one thing and acting another way. It should be as you teach, so you live. And if I teach generosity, then I too have to be generous. And so sometimes I give. And I remember one lady ringing me up and said, what do you get out of this? You know, you go over here to Singapore, and then you go over to the United States, and then you go to Melbourne and Sydney, you go all over the place. Surely you must be tired giving all these things. What do you get out of it, Ajahn Brahm? I just was in here signing books. You know what I get out of signing books? A sore hand. But no, that's, I get much more than that. Because when you give, you get happiness back. And that's my happiness. The more I give for other people, not expecting anything back in return, the more happiness I get back. This is one great teaching of spirituality. The selfless, compassionate giving is not just for other people, it's also for you. Because what's for you is for others. And it's important that we understand that in our modern world. Because what that means is we have a religion, have a spirituality, which is honest, which is true, which hasn't got any hypocrisy. Some of the hypocrites which I've known in this world, people who say you should live simply, but then live in penthouses. People who beg for alms, but then they live in such wonderful places. For me as a Westerner, I thought that was just not on. I made a resolution years ago that I would never live in a dwelling in my monastery which was more luxurious than the poorest of my supporters. If I had a supporter who had no home, then I would move out of my hut. Because I was a monk, I should be teaching not just with words, but also by example. And many of you have visited my monastery in Australia, and I think, Angie, you've seen my hut. You know what's in there. There's very little in there. If any of you want to see my baggage when I arrived in Singapore, and you want to see my baggage when I leave tomorrow afternoon, come to the airport, and you can see my cabin baggage and my check-in baggage. My cabin baggage, or check-in baggage, is nothing. What I take inside the cabin, where has it gone? Good. It's that. That's my cabin baggage. That's all I take coming to Singapore. So I live simply as an example just how religion can actually teach you how little you need but how much you can give. So Buddhism in our modern age is something which would teach not just by words but by example. There's a story I remember from one of the great people of the last century, Gandhi. Many of you might know the story of what's now called Mahatma Gandhi. When he was a student lawyer, he studied in London. When he was studying, he was staying in a boarding house. In a boarding house in London, even in that time when he was still very young, he was a very impressive man. So much so that his landlady, the owner of the house, took him aside one day and said, "My son is eating too much sugar. I've tried to tell him, but he will not listen to me." Sons haven't changed over 100 years. So, they said, "Somehow, Mr. Gandhi, he respects you. Maybe you can tell my son not to eat too much sugar. It's bad for his health." And Mr. Gandhi said, "Yes, madam, I will do that." A couple of weeks later, the child was still eating lots of sugar. So the landlady came up to Mr. Gandhi and said, "Don't you remember what I asked you? To ask my son not to take so much sugar? And he's still taking so much sugar. Why haven't you told my son to stop taking so much sugar?" And Mr. Gandhi said, "But I have told your son just this morning." And the landlady said, "Why did you wait 2 weeks to tell my son? Why did you tell him just this morning not to take so much sugar?" "Because, madam," said Mr. Gandhi, "only yesterday I gave up sugar." Now that's very important. How can a monk sit up here and tell people to be good if the monk isn't being good. This is what we call honesty, spiritual sincerity, where if Buddhism or any religion is going to succeed in our modern times, we have to teach not just by words, but by example. And I try to open up my monastery, to open up my monks, so we don't hide anything. If you really wanted to, you can have a look in my bag and see what I've got in there. I have no secrets. And this is wonderful, to be so open that people can have faith and trust. We need to test these things out by ourselves. For Buddhism to survive in the modern world, for any religion to survive in this modern world, it has to be tested. People will not take things on faith anymore. Fortunately, I was a scientist before I became a monk, so I was into testing everything. And when I saw someone like Ajahn Chah, my basic meditation teacher, I would not believe him just because he was famous. I wanted to see for myself. And it's important that you could actually test it out for yourself. This is a beautiful thing about Buddhism. You can ask any question you like, and whatever question you ask will be respected. If you ask a question and I give you an answer which doesn't make sense, please ask it again. Because otherwise, I am not respecting, you know, your search for truth. And if you don't believe it, go away. Fortunately, as I was saying last night, that Buddhism is one of those faiths which will actually change the faith to fit the facts, but will not try and change the facts to fit the faith. And this is one of the wonderful things about Buddhism in our modern age. You can test it, you can compare it to modern science, and it fits. That's why I was a theoretical physicist. In that sense, I still am a physicist, because I know the Buddha's teachings have no conflict whatsoever with science. Other religions, they still do. I know that there's something happening in the United States now, many of you may have read it in the newspapers, where some groups are trying to promote what they call intelligent design. Instead of thinking about the world was created by a god, or instead of thinking about evolution, they say that it's an intelligent design, something a bit more complicated than creation. But when you look at it, you have to test it out and to see what you mean by an intelligent design. Can there be like a god figure who's in control of this world? As we were saying last night, that just doesn't fit, that a compassionate, powerful being could allow tsunamis, dengue fever, earthquakes, hurricanes to happen in this world. So actually, what makes this world run? What causes things? Who created this world? And Buddhism has a sensible answer to these things, something which actually fits with science. Yeah, in one sense there is design, but it's not by some god or some great being outside. You are the designers. I remember seeing ants' nests being built. Every little ant contributed, and they built this great big nest. Every person contributed to the building of Singapore. No god built Singapore. If you look upon all the building contracts in the government offices, you don't have the God Building Company. What you do have is all these different contractors. Many, many people working together to create Singapore. This is evidence of actually how this world is created. So many millions of people interacting together with each of our desires, work, effort. This is what creates our world. And sometimes it is not intelligent design, because sometimes we make big mistakes. But design, yes, not coming from somewhere else, but coming from you. So this is how Buddhism makes sense to our world. when we realize it's we are the creators, you create your world, then you are empowered. By empowered, I mean if it was up to someone else, all you can do is just to beg those people in authority to please get me some happiness. You just have to pray. And sometimes praying just does not work. I know many people who believe in a God who die of cancer when they're young. Where does all this praying actually get you? Sometimes we take responsibility instead of actually asking someone else to do it for us. In other words, we do the work. We realize that we are in control of our destiny. This is what I was saying last night in the Law of Karma. We are the creators of our happiness, and you are in full power to determine what's going to happen to you in this life, in this world. You can create happiness for yourself. We can create a good world. It's up to us. So stop waiting for somebody else. So when we understand this, we understand how it's a religion in the world which can inspire us and lead us to take responsibility and to do something with whatever we have to deal with in life. So the Buddhism gives you that framework, that inspiration, that help to find out what really needs to be done in life. It's a strange thing, as a monk, as a celibate monk for over 30 years, that many people ask me about their marriage problems. And I say, that's unfair. I became a monk to get rid of all of that rubbish. And why are you asking me? I'm not married. I've never been married. Why are you asking me about your marriage problems? But I do, just before I came here. The morning before I flew off from Perth to Singapore, I got a telephone call all the way from some desert in the United States, some woman who wanted marriage counseling over the phone. It's called Dial a Monk Service. And so often I get asked questions on marriage. I told a story in the book. I went to a radio show once organized by my disciples in Perth, and I was heedless. I never asked why or what show I was going to talk on. Only when I got into the studio, only when I was actually sitting down in the seat in front of the microphone, did they tell me it was a show on adult themes. In other words, sex and relationships. And there I was with one of the famous sexologists in Perth answering questions about people's intimate affairs. And I thought, what am I doing here? But a strange thing happened. That I'm a Buddhist monk and I was fielding all these questions because people started ringing up. There was two of us there, this famous sexologist who writes books on the subject. I've seen them in the airport. And me, this Buddhist monk. After a short while, everybody was ringing up to speak to the Buddhist monk. It was strange. I was making more sense. It's even some years ago, I went to a transport seminar in Perth. Somebody interviewed me about shipping. I haven't got a clue about shipping. But whatever the interview was, they asked questions, I just gave answers. And I saw the journalist about a year later. He said, you know that interview I did? I put that essay, that piece, I titled it Zen and the Art of Shipping. It was published not in one newspaper, but in all the shipping magazines of the world. It was actually quite well known. And I thought, my goodness. And he told me that his friend said, wow, that monk, he really knows what he's talking about. Actually, I didn't know what I was talking about at all. All I knew was about goodness, kindness, peace, wisdom, caring, the long-term benefits. And it amazed me. Just Buddhism actually worked. And was observed by non-Buddhists, experts in the shipping industry, as relevant, important, and helpful. Which is why that Buddhism helps in your marriages as well. In a week or two's time, I'll be going to Bangkok for a Buddhist summit. I was invited by the Australian Embassy in Bangkok to give a talk. They've arranged a talk in the Royal Bangkok Sports Club. The reason why they arranged the talk was because this little book, Open the Door of Your Heart, has been distributed in the Australian Embassy in Bangkok, and the soul has saved at least 4 marriages. And they rang up and said, Ajahn Bom, you don't realize just what effect your book has had. It's actually kept 4 people, or 4 couples, from getting divorced. And if any of you have been through a divorce, you know how much suffering, how much pain that is. Not just to the husband and wife, but to the kids and the rest of the family. And somehow or other, these Dhamma teachings, Buddhism, has actually kept couples together. And I'm so happy about that. That this Dhamma in the modern world, Buddhism in the modern world, is not just something you practice in the temple. It's not just something which you do, you know, once a week or once a month or once a year. It's actually something which is relevant to your life, which actually allows you to find a nice partner in life and to live happily with them, to learn how to coexist with somebody else. Again, before I came in here, someone said, is it okay, I'm a Buddhist, to marry a Christian? I said, it's a wonderful thing to marry a Christian, if you're a Buddhist. You know why? Because you'll be showing by example how two religions can live together in harmony, that close, there's a husband and wife. And I said, if you have children, make one child a Muslim and the other one a Hindu. Wouldn't that be wonderful to have a... Because we have to live together in this world. There's no space for us to leave. One of the stories in the book about this couple, I'm going to be seeing her in Toronto when I go over there in 3 or 4 weeks' time. She was in a boat going from Perth to Vancouver with her husband and with 2 friends. It's a true story. Halfway between Australia and Canada, in the middle of the Indian Ocean, their boat was becalmed. There was engine trouble. So the 2 men went down into the engine compartment to try and fix up the problem, while the 2 women were on deck reading newspapers, reading magazines. There was nothing they could do. It was men's business. So there in the middle of the ocean, hundreds of miles from anywhere, the 2 men were working, trying to fix up the problem. If any of you have ever tried fixing up a car or any engine, you know that sometimes it can get very, very frustrating. And they were getting frustrated. And it was hot. Frustration soon became irritation. Irritation became anger. And anger soon burst into a full-flown argument. They were shouting insults at each other, arguing, until one of them was so angry, they threw down their wrench and said, right, that's it, I'm leaving. And true story, they were so mad with anger, they went to their cabin, they changed out of their work clothes into clean clothes, packed their bags, and they appeared on deck carrying their suitcases. And it was only because the 2 girls laughed. They almost fell off the boat laughing. But he realized as he looked around, there was ocean in all directions. There was nowhere to go. He did the only thing which you can do when there's nowhere to go. He turned around, red faced, went back to the cabin, put on his work clothes again, and went down into the engine room to help. There was no other opportunity, no other possibility, nothing else to do. They fixed that engine, and they remained close friends. How fortunate it was They were surrounded by ocean with nowhere else to go. Just like our planet Earth. Where can we go? To escape the wars, the terrorism? There's no place to go. That's why it's a waste of time getting angry. Instead of getting angry thinking we can leave and go somewhere else, we have to go back into the engine room with our enemies and fix up the problem together. It's like your marriage. Sometimes there's just nowhere to go. Sometimes you think, right, that's it, I'm leaving. If you look around, nowhere to go. So you stick together. You work it out. You make it work. And one thing which Buddhism says, 99.9% of the time, you can always fix up that engine if you keep on going. That's why stories such as those has actually saved so many marriages. This is what Buddhism in the modern age should be doing. Not just telling you to go and make good karma or do some chanting and praying. Yeah, that's very good to meditate, but you also need to have some guidance, some wise spiritual guidance, so you can live your life in peace and harmony together. Not just with your friends in the office, but with your wife or your husband, with your friends and with those people who aren't of the same religion as you, who aren't of the same race as you, who don't support the same soccer team as you do. Whatever, to be able to live in peace and harmony. And Buddhism in the modern world can teach you that, because the Buddhism was always a harmonious religion. Never ever has any war been fought in the name of Buddhism. And those wise teachings are something which you can test out for yourself, which fits with science. If it doesn't work, please throw it away. If it does work, try it out. See if it makes you more peaceful and happy. In the end, Buddhism from modern times, what is the essence of Buddhism? The essence of Buddhism was always what we call the Four Noble Truths, which in these modern times, actually not just in modern times, but in their very essence, is all about happiness. The Four Truths of Buddhism, happiness, the cause of happiness. That sometimes we're unhappy and why we're unhappy. Those are the Buddha's Four Noble Truths rearranged. But it's important that we teach like this, because what people come to a temple for is to find happiness. What you get married for is to find happiness. What you have children for is to find happiness. What you work for is for happiness. And Buddhism, because of its wise teachings, because of its such beautiful morality and virtue, can help you find happiness. Yesterday, I dealt with the problem which people have with homosexuality. In Buddhism, there is no problem there at all. The homosexual community are fully welcome, without any restrictions whatsoever, without any criticism. We talk about things like euthanasia, stem cell research. In Buddhism, we don't say, it's said somewhere, you can't do these things. As I mentioned yesterday, the Buddhism has this beautiful way. You can make your own decision. The teachings are there to help you. But you, in the end, have to make your decision. The precepts, the five Buddhist precepts, are not sort of saying, you shall not do these things. Buddhist teachings are so practical. You know the five Buddhist precepts, not to kill, not to deliberately kill, not to steal, not to commit adultery, not to lie, not to take alcohol or drugs. One of my disciples, he only died recently, about 3 or 4 weeks ago. About 5 or 6 years earlier, he had a heart attack. He was taken to the hospital. I went to go and see him. He had blocked arteries. He was due for a heart bypass operation. He was in a war with 3 other men. That's what happens if you're in a ward in a confined space for a long time. You become friends with each other. And becoming friends with each other, his friend in the next bed was also due for the bypass operation before him. So when his friend had the operation, that evening when his wife visited, He asked his wife, "How's Jack? How did his operation go?" His wife, Pat, said, "Oh, no trouble at all, Don. He's in the ICU unit, recovering." This man's wife called me that evening in great distress. She said, "I've just lied to my husband. This is the first time in 30 years of marriage that I've had to lie to him. Because the truth was that Jack died on the operating table. The heart bypass operation didn't work." And she said, "I just couldn't tell my husband that his friend had died from the same operation my husband's having the day after tomorrow." She said, "The fear would probably kill him. But I've lied to my own husband. Have I broken my precepts? Have I done wrong?" When I thought about it, I said, technically you've broken your precepts, but you've done nothing wrong. Because, because the precepts do not say, "I shall not lie." They say, "I shall refrain from lying."
They're not going to start using this as an example.
I'm going to use this as an example because I told people afterwards, in those cases, if your husband is going to die by telling the truth, maybe it's okay. Once every 30 years to tell a lie, but no more than that. It's like the traffic lights. If I have a heart attack here in Pokhaksi Khomeng Sun, and you put me in your car, I would hope you go through the red lights. The red lights are there to stop you unless it's an emergency. And what happens if I'm in the back of your car with a heart attack, rushing me to hospital? Every second is important. I'd expect you to stop at those red lights, to look. If you thought it was safe, you'd go through. And no policeman would ever prosecute you for that if it's an emergency. You would stop and make sure it's safe. That's why in Buddhism these five precepts are just like that. They're red traffic lights. Nearly every occasion in your life you have to stop. But the great thing about Buddhism, wisdom and compassion is important. You stop and you look. And if it really is an emergency, then you go through. Once every 30 years, no more. So what we're saying here is, this is actually the practicality of Buddhism. And when I heard these sorts of teachings, I loved them because, yeah, they made sense. And I wasn't afraid. And I kept these precepts because I understood them and why I should keep them. And they worked. For those of you who haven't heard the stories about alcohol, one of my favorite stories about the dangers of alcohol is the story of the man who got drunk in Sydney, got stopped to the roadblock. That's not in the book, but I think I told it maybe about a year ago. But there's some new people here. It's a great story. He got stopped in a roadblock. In these roadblocks, the police take your blood alcohol level. You have to blow into a tube. The breathalyzer, it's called. And if your alcohol level in your breath is above a certain limit, you get prosecuted. You lose your license and get fined many hundreds of dollars because drink driving is a danger to other people. This man had been drinking alcohol. He was way over the limit. He was in this police roadblock. There was no way out. And so he resigned himself to having a huge fine and losing his license. However, when it came his turn to have his breath tested, he stepped out of the car and the policeman was about to put the breath tube into his mouth and ask him to blow when there was a sound of a traffic accident. Two cars had collided because the roadblock was a traffic hazard. The policeman heard it, this drunk man heard it, and the policeman told him, "Sir, it's more important I deal with this accident than test your blood, your alcohol level. Get back in your car and go home." He said he was so lucky he came so close to being caught. But that wasn't the end of the story. Because the following morning, he was woken up with a hangover, with somebody knocking at his door. He quickly got into some clothes, he answered the door, and there was two big policemen, two big Australian policemen at his door. He was afraid at first, but then he thought, I'm not driving now, how can they prosecute me? And the policeman said, sir, would you mind if we look in your garage? He said, sure, I'm not hiding anything, it's only my car in my garage. So he took the two policemen to his garage and opened the door. When he opened the door, he almost had a heart attack. Because in his garage was not his car. In his garage was one of the police cars. He'd been so drunk, when he got out of his car and they told him, get in your car and go back home, he got in the wrong car. He drove a police car back. That's big trouble. They had an extra car at the roadblock. They were missing a car. Now that's what happens sometimes if you get drunk. So we keep these precepts for the sake of happiness and safety. For all you young people, I gave up alcohol when I was a student. And it's wonderful to give up alcohol. Because when I went to the parties, I was in full control. And I could enjoy the last 2 hours. That was the fun part. Before then, I wouldn't remember the last couple of hours, what I was doing. When I gave up alcohol, I thought I wasn't going to get invited to any parties anymore. But it was the opposite. When I gave up alcohol as a student at Cambridge, I got more invitations to parties than I had before. You know why? Because my friends wanted somebody sober to drive them home. There are many advantages. So anyway, this is Buddhism in our modern world. Create happiness and peace and joy for all beings. So, that's the beginning of this talk. Now we're going to have some discussion and Q&A afterwards. So thank you so far.
Ajahn Brahm, in the Buddhist time, when the Buddha came up with, when he started to teach, he just taught. But today now we have four traditions, or main traditions anyway, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and Zen. And sometimes this is confusing to people. It's like, why are there four different traditions or four different flavors, and which is the one that I should choose?
Okay. So which is the one you should choose? There's always the case that people make different distinctions between these different traditions. The history behind those traditions is just historical and geographical. Now, when Buddhism went to one place, it developed in one way. When it went to another place, it went to another way. It developed according to the climate and the place where it developed. And so now we are seeing like Singaporean Buddhism developing with its own special style. But one of the wonderful things about Buddhism, they all come from the same source, the teachings of the Buddha. So if we go back to the original teachings of the Buddha and follow them as our core, we have something which all Buddhists can come together in. Recently in Australia, we formed the Australia Sangha Association. We've actually brought all the traditions together under one umbrella. And we are all friends. Because the more I get in contact with true practitioners of the major religions, or the major parts of Buddhism, you find there is a common core there. And that common core I've discussed this evening. One of them is you have to ask questions, don't just believe. Investigate, don't just take it for granted. Read the suttas, compare them, find out which suttas were taught by the Buddha and which were added afterwards. And all traditions have added things. So because of that we can come back to the common core. And when you come back to the common core of Buddhism, people ask me today, how do I know what is real Buddhism, what is not real Buddhism? And I say, you can know what real Buddhism is if it brings you peace and happiness, both in your inner life and in your worldly life with your family, in your office. If it brings you prosperity, both inner and outer, you know that that must be truth. You know truth by its effects. If it makes you more miserable, that cannot be truth. So I try to market this truth by my smile. So in other words, to say, well, you know, you've all seen me for a long time, many of you. And you know I don't just smile up here in public. also in private as well. You can actually sneak up on me when I'm alone in my room and take a picture of me and see, does Ajahn Brahm smile when no one's looking?
But Ajahn Brahm, you're considered in the Theravadin tradition. And sometimes people think that's really hard, because Theravadin tradition, you're asked to walk the path, and the only way to find happiness is through your own effort. Whereas the other traditions, like Mahayana tradition, they've got Guan Yin, they've got Manjushri, they've got Earth's Door Buddha, Bodhisattva, and then you have Vajrayana tradition that even have Tara. You know, it's like they've got a lot more help. So, so what's your comment in terms of, you know, these variations of Buddhism that promises more avenues of help when they need some assistance beyond their ability?
Have you ever been like having a problem with your computer and there's too many people trying to help you? It's called too many cooks boil the broth. And sometimes you get so many people trying to help you, say, please, just one is enough. So sometimes simplicity is very important. So directness and simplicity. And so it's good that we can have help, but sometimes it gets so complicated we don't know where we are. And in the end, again, we have to help ourselves most of all. It's a great saying of the Buddha, that Buddhas show the way. They encourage us, but we have to walk that way. We are like the tennis player or the soccer player. The monks, the teachers, they're like the people in the grandstand. They can cheer you on, they can shout advice, but you have to kick the ball yourself. And that's actually the job of a teacher, to encourage, to inspire, but in the end, you have to do it yourself. If you give a schoolboy or a schoolgirl too much assistance with their homework, then they're never going to learn how to do it themselves. So sometimes holding a person's hands too long is not being kind to them. But you know, these are just different ways of looking at compassion. Sometimes people visualize compassion by looking at Kuan Yin. It doesn't really matter just what the technique is, as long as you keep it simple. Because sometimes with too much complexity, it gets just too difficult. So keep it simple, keep it effective. But basically, if it works, then follow it.
Well, in Zen Buddhism, as we had heard during the conference, that they talk about getting back your original mind. It's like the mind's been always there, and it's a clear mind, but along the way we've got it contaminated. And our strive should be to get this original mind back. How does that relate back to Buddhist teachings?
How does the original mind relate to Buddhist teachings? Again, there is no such thing as an original mind. That your mind is always changing. And because it's always changing, you can actually change it to whatever you want to. If there was an original mind, you'd be stuck somewhere. So what I actually really mean there, that I think what it really is meaning is that sometimes the human being has like almost an essential purity, an essential goodness. And sometimes that because of the lack of wisdom, sometimes because of the lack of effort and guidance, sometimes we could do stupid things. In one sense, everybody has a essence of purity inside of them. Now this is actually the Mahayana teaching of a Buddha nature. I say this because I've never seen a criminal, even though I've worked in jails, you know, counselling and helping and serving in those jails, I've never seen sort of a terrorist. I've never seen a rapist or a murderer. All I've seen is someone who's done a crime. I've seen someone who's done a rape. I've seen someone who's done a terrorist act. There's a lot of difference between seeing a criminal and seeing a person who's done a crime. What it's doing is seeing somebody much more than those one or two actions which they've done. You don't define a person because of one or two mistakes. This is a story in the book which again has saved many marriages. That once I was in Kuala Lumpur, asked a question after a talk, and the question was this: my husband has just lied to me. I can't trust him anymore. Should I get divorced? Now some of you women might have had the same feeling. You found your husband has actually made a lie. I can't trust him anymore. The talk was held at a university. So I asked the question, what are you doing at this university? She said she was a lecturer in mathematics. So I said, madam, we'll do some statistics. How long have you been married to that guy? She said, 3 years. I said, that's approximately 1,000 days you've been married to that man. Let's assume, on average, he said 20 things to you over that time you've been married. 20 things every day on average, which could have been right or wrong. So he said 20,000 things to you since you got married, and now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, that means the next time he says something, there's a 20,000-to-1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? When I made it that comment in that way, what it pointed out is that we make one lie and that's all we see. Your husband's made a lie, therefore he's a liar. No. Your husband is a person who's told a lie. They're much more than that one or two acts which they do. And I see that's how we can see that a person is not their mistakes. Therefore, there's something more than their mistakes, more than their defilements. That, I think, is what we can say is like an original mind. Not really an original mind, but there's something more than the mistakes which people make in life. When you focus on that, their goodness, then they actually grow.
Right, we're going to have to answers short.
Okay.
Look at the pile of questions I've got here. The Buddha said to follow his teachings and not just perform rituals, but today you see people offering flowers and using joysticks and burning offerings and offering food and stuff like that. Could you please comment on that, whether that's a right practice or is it encouraged practice?
Okay, sometimes you can do some rituals, but don't do too many rituals. You spend all your time doing rituals and doing nothing which is more essential, learning for yourself. Sometimes a ritual is helpful. You can light some joysticks over there to keep away the mosquitoes when you when you're meditating. But just to keep it practical. So I was saying yesterday, sometimes we do ghost chanting to get rid of the ghosts, but the ritual of our monastery to get rid of ghosts, and it's very effective, is to make the chanting so awful and out of tune that the ghosts run away.
Does Buddhism believe in the creator God? If not, how does it then compete with religions who offer the God as a salvation?
Because Buddhism actually can quote science, and science does not believe in a creator God. It's actually completely ridiculous for theoretical physicists to say that there could be the creator God who created this world 10,000 years ago. You don't need to believe in evolution. Just look at geology. Just look into the sky, and in the sky you can see stars and galaxies, which are hundreds of thousands of light years away. You can see that with your own eyes. You can see back in time when you look at the sky. That's why if you use your common sense and you do use science, then the idea of a creator God becomes untenable, illogical, irrational. It cannot hold water. So in Buddhism we teach people to be intelligent. As I said earlier, you change your faith to fit the facts, not the other way around. So you don't manipulate the facts of science. Look at science. Look at the facts. And if it doesn't, Buddhism doesn't fit, change your Buddhist beliefs. Don't take it. If you're a Christian, check science. The scientific method, which was started by Francis Bacon, the founder of the Royal Society in London, was to have a theory and try your hardest to disprove it. So all the science should be to try and disprove all these ideas of science. And only when you've tried and tried and tried, you can't disprove it, then you can say that's pretty valid. In many religions, you don't even try to disprove it at all. In fact, you're said to be a sinner or evil if you try and argue with established religious dogma. Not in Buddhism. I encourage each one of you to try and disprove anything which the Buddha said. Try it. Try it, try it. If you're a Christian, try and disprove your Christianity. That is how we can test it and find out if it's true or not. It's the same if you get married. Before you get married, you test out your partner first of all. You check them out. Sometimes, as I say, you take them for a test drive beforehand.
But if there isn't this so-called God, then why are there so many people in this world who believe in this creator God? How has it come about then?
It was Voltaire, the great French philosopher and playwright, who once said, the only way you can understand, you can fully comprehend the mathematical concept of infinity is to contemplate the extent of human stupidity. Because it's amazing sometimes how stupid people can be. And there's still some people who think that there's a guy called Noah who put all these animals in a boat. Have you ever been to Singapore Zoo? They've hardly got a fraction of all the animals in this world. You need a boat which is bigger than any tanker you see in the Straits of Singapore to get all the animals. I mean, it's just absolutely ridiculous. It's illogical, irrational. And even was it Aquinas, one of the early church fathers, he said, because it's illogical, therefore I believe. To me, that was just almost like a confession of stupidity. So I was an iconoclast. I wanted to tear things down if it didn't make sense. And I think our modern spirituality, we should be more assertive, more aggressive to find the truth. Don't just believe what you're told. Check it out, investigate until you can find out. And I think Buddhism is, I would say it's perhaps the only religion in our world which actually can take all those questions and which will never sort of stop you questioning, which actually invites and encourages you to push, investigate, just like science. That's why of all the religions, Buddhism, all the great scientists like Einstein, it was Buddhism which they thought was going to be the one which survived science.
Ajahn Brahm, often when we ask teachers what's Nibbana or enlightenment, because that's supposed to be our goal as Buddhists, and most of them say, oh, you can't understand it, but I try to explain to it because it's just too hard for you to understand because you're not there yet. Do you have a easy, simple to understand explanation for everyone here?
Yeah, it's the one which I said at the Zen conference this afternoon. It's one which is in the book. It's a great explanation of Nibbana. Many of you have heard it before, but I mention this simile for Nibbana because it is true what Andrew said. If you cannot get a decent answer, you should not believe in these things. And my particular story, one of the reasons why I rejected Christianity was because no one could give me a straight answer what God is. Have you ever asked a person who believes in God, what actually is God? And when I asked my chaplain at my school and high school, when I asked the members of Christianity, which I knew, they would say that God is ineffable. It's beyond words. It's like cosmic, the ground of all being, unexplainable. When they said things like that, I thought, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. He's making it up. Because if you knew what you were talking about, you'd be able to explain it. My trouble was that when I rejected Christianity, because no one can give me a straight answer what God is, when I became a Buddhist, I started asking my monks what Nibbana is. You know what they said? Nibbana is ungraspable, ineffable, beyond words. I've heard that before. And basically, I was about to reject Buddhism as well, because can anyone really give a straight answer what Nibbana is? Because to me, it was like you were getting on a bus to Nibbana, not knowing what that destination is like. Isn't that a stupid thing, to go to Changi Airport and go on any plane not knowing where you're going to go, or what it's going to be like when you get there? So I was very pleased to see teachers who could give straight answers to what Nibbana is. The first straight answer was Nibbana is the highest happiness. That in your path of spirituality you get happier and happier and happier. You keep precepts, you become happier, you're virtuous, you are happy. You meditate, you get really happy, you get wise, you go to extreme happiness. The whole spiritual path is an increase of happiness. Nibbana is the pinnacle of that happiness, the highest happiness in this world. But there's another simile which shows what that happiness truly is. It's a simile of the wishing game, which I said this afternoon at the Zen conference. Wishing game goes like this. 5 children playing a wishing game. The one with the best wish wins the wishing game. So they ask the first child, if you had one wish, what would it be? He said, if I had one wish, I'd wish for a McDonald's hamburger. Because he liked McDonald's and double fries. Very good. Ask the second child, if you had a wish, what would it be? The second child, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a McDonald's restaurant. Because if I had my own McDonald's restaurant, I could have not just one hamburger. I could have a hamburger every day. And maybe some other things as well. Whenever I wanted it, my mother could not stop me because I own the joint. Very good, they said. They asked the third child, if you had one wish, what would it be? He said, if I had a wish, he had longer time to think. He said, I'd wish for $1 billion. Not Singaporean, but US. Because with $1 billion, I could buy my own McDonald's restaurant. Then I'd buy my own school. When I bought my own school, I would not set myself any homework. Because I own the school, at the end of the year, I give myself top marks. I could also buy my own computer game store. So I could buy whatever I want. With $1 billion, I'd have enough for the rest of my life to buy whatever I want whenever I wanted it. And the other two children, the one who'd only got an ice cream, the one who'd only got a McDonald's hamburger, and the one who got the restaurant, thought, how stupid we are, and how clever is that boy who's got $1 billion US. Surely you can't beat that in the wishing game. The next child did much better than the $1 billion wish. He said, if I had a wish, I would wish for 3 wishes. That's a wish. And then my first wish, I'll have the McDonald's restaurant. My second wish, I'd have the $1 billion US. And for my third wish, I'll have 3 more wishes. That way, I can go on forever. And the first 3 children thought, now that is a genius. That must be the person who wins the wishing game. How can you do better than an infinity of wishes? There was one child left. The last child won the wishing game. He managed to think of a wish which was far more superior than having an infinity of wishes. That child said, if I had a wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. That was the Buddha describing Nibbana. So content, you don't need anything ever again. No more wishes needed. Now you understand what Nibbana is. Full contentment, where you never need to wish for anything ever again. Now that's something you can understand. That's something which gives you an explanation of what Nibbana is. The end of craving, said the Buddha. Full contentment, peace at last. Now you know that heaven realms are not real happiness. The only real happiness is absolute contentment.
Some Buddhists aim to be reborn in the Pure Land as taught by the Amitabha school. Could you please comment on that? Does it really exist, this Pure Land?
According to the Amitabha Sutra, it's supposed to be the Western Paradise. I've been to the West, many of you have been to the West. It's not a paradise.
Will I go to hell if I don't accept Jesus Christ as my Savior?
Okay. No, you won't go to hell if you You'd go to hell if you're a bad person, if you do bad things. It doesn't matter whether you're a Christian, whether you're a Buddhist, or whether you don't believe in anything at all. Bad people go to bad places. Is it the case in Christian countries that if you believe in Christ, you don't go to jail when you rob a house? Is it the case that only Buddhists and Hindus, Muslims and Jews go into prison? No, you go to jail if you commit a crime. It's the same with going to hell. If you do something bad, evil, you hurt another being, that's bad karma. And bad karma has a natural punishment. It doesn't depend upon whether you're a Christian or Buddhist or whatever. It depends on what you do. So you tell that Christian who said that, you're going to go to hell for saying that. And they say, ah!
One of the precepts is to refrain from sexual misconduct and adultery.
Yeah.
The question is, can we be flexible about it? Maybe once every 30 years. No, that part I added. And the other part of the question is visiting a prostitute breaking the precept?
Okay. Can we be flexible about sexual misconduct? I go back to the, suppose that you've just robbed a house. And you say to the judge, can't we be flexible about this, judge? Of course not. There's no flexibility with the law of gravity. What goes up comes down. It's just a natural law. You can't actually just go and argue with the law of gravity or other sort of laws of nature. So the point is that, you know, sexual misconduct actually hurts the person you've committed to. Many years ago, you got married to somebody. And that marriage is a commitment. You're saying to that person, you're the one I've chosen, and I'm going to live with you. My sexual partner, my emotional friend, my best friend. It's called commitment. When you are going out with someone, boyfriend and girlfriend, it's only called involvement. So when I marry anybody, I tell them the difference between involvement and commitment. Now you're married, you're committed, I said. Before you were just involved. To make the point, I said the difference between involvement and commitment is the same as the difference between bacon and eggs. Do you understand? In bacon and eggs, think about it, the pig is committed, the chicken is only involved. So all marriages should be bacon marriages. In other words, you give your whole life to this marriage. Full 100% commitment. Just with that person, no one else.
Well, now, so what happens if you're the bacon, but your spouse has become a chicken? Because he's also involved in with another partner.
Yeah. Well, if it is your partner who's doing the problem, that's basically their bad karma. Just out of kindness, to see if there's anything you can do about that situation. Number one, don't feel guilty. Number two, see if there's... Now, why are they going to seek for somebody else? And maybe it is because, you know, that maybe that you're not being kind and caring enough to your partner. Maybe you're not trying to actually to make yourself look attractive to your partner. Maybe you've got lazy in sort of, you know, doing your hair, brushing your teeth, and getting nice hairstyles and wearing nice clothes. I don't know what it is, but there's something you can do to attract your partner. They fell in love with you once. Maybe they can fall in love with you again. You know what happens in a relationship? We take the other person for granted. And we don't have that intimacy, that time together, which is important for a relationship to continue to grow. Just because you fall in love once, it doesn't mean that it's going to be like that forever. Sometimes a relationship, like falling in love, is like starting a fire. When you light a fire, you start with paper. That's a big flame, but it doesn't last very long. You've got to put on the twigs, the kindling, and then the bigger pieces of wood. And only when you've got the big logs on that fire can you say that fire is established. This is like a relationship. You fall in love, but you've got to spend time together. You have experience together. You go through the problems together. That's lighting the big logs. Once you've got the big logs going, you know, a husband and wife, they've been through stuff together, then you've got a relationship. However, even big logs, because of inattention, they can almost burn out. That's why when you do find your partnership starting to get cool, you've got to put on more kindling. You've got to work at it. You've got to fan it, blow on it to get the fire going again. Take your partner out to an expensive restaurant. Do something romantic, whatever it is. These are just common ways of actually keeping your relationship going. Do not take your partner for granted. So sometimes that's the reason why your partner does go out to a prostitute or go out to another woman or another man. Sometimes we haven't been caring enough. We forgot the importance of our relationship. But if it's got to that point, see if you can win the guy back again. If you can't do anything at all, leave it alone. See if you can forgive him. There's an old story by Somerset Maugham. If I remember it correctly, it was a story about some English planters. It could have been in Malaysia. And the man with his wife was working a plantation, and his best friend came to visit for a while. His best friend had an accident and died. And as soon as the word came that his best friend had died, his wife fainted. You'd only faint on the word, on the news of someone dying, if that person was your lover. The man realized his wife was having an affair with his best friend. He wanted to divorce her and send her back to England. But another planter who lived next door said, "Please don't do that. Because I did that to my wife. She had an affair. I sent her home. She asked forgiveness. I never gave it. Now I'm a lonely old man. I should have forgiven her and given her another chance. It's worth it." So don't just throw people away that easy. A relationship which you've worked for so many years to build up. If some partner makes a mistake, can't we say to them, like the story after which my book is named, "Husband, wife, the door of my heart's open to you. I've got enough love to forgive you." If you can really say that, that's why it's the title of my book. My father said that to me. It gave me absolute forgiveness. Something happened inside me. I would never ever harm that man. Anyone who gives you that unconditional love and acceptance moves something deep inside of you. You don't want to hurt them anymore. If you forgive your husband with that understanding, with that depth, he can be so moved, or she can be so moved. Think, "My goodness, I'm so lucky to have a person like that. I don't want to hurt them ever again. I'm so sorry." Sometimes that works. See what you can do if they're having a relationship like that outside of marriage. Why do they want to go and visit a prostitute? The truth of the matter is that most prostitutes are not in that profession because they want to. It's a terrible profession. A profession of exploitation, of pain. Sometimes we think that they're coming here from China or whatever to earn some money which they couldn't earn outside. There's lots of illegal activity involved with prostitution. You actually ask the girls who've been in that trade. It's not a very nice situation to be in. So maybe we shouldn't support it. You're just supporting a very evil, harmful, cruel business.
Ajahn Brahm, my wife...
Not that I would know what it's all about.
You're a good marriage counsellor for someone who's never been married. My wife's suffering from cancer, and I've been with her most of the time. But sometimes I feel like I need a break, but she won't let me because she thinks that I should be with her all the time because she's suffering from an illness. Can you please comment?
Okay. Okay. It's just like people in offices, they work so hard and then they get inefficient. They just can't do their work properly when they get tired. It's the same if you've got a partner who's looking after you. Please, out of compassion for yourself and compassion for them, tell them to take a break. If we don't take the breaks in life, we get so tired that we get grumpy, we get ill, we can't do our job properly. So if you give your carer time off, it's called respite, then they go away, they can relax, and when they come back, they'll care for you so much better than they did before. So it's important to give them time off. It's in your own interest to do so. It's also in theirs as well. It's very, very hard work to look after someone who's dying. Even nurses. Can you manage 24 hours a day looking after a patient? Nurses have to take holidays, weekends off. So certainly your carer should take that time off. And there are many organizations which will give respite care. So you can take a holiday. And when your partner comes back, they'll be such a wonderful partner. And you'll think, oh great, please go away again. Compassion should always go both ways. To them and to me and to them. Not just one way. So don't just think of your own illness. Think of other people as well.
Ajahn Brahm, my uncle met an accident and he's considered brain dead. What is your view on this condition? And sometimes people in coma are known to know what's happening.
Okay, if someone is so-called brain dead, they're in a coma, sometimes people come out of that coma. Most times they don't. So it's a difficult situation. Maybe your loved one is on a ventilator, just being kept alive by the machine, so you think, and you're the one who has to make the decision. You're asked by the doctor, shall we turn off the machines or shall we keep them running? It's not an easy decision because there's financial problems involved with keeping the machine going for so long. And there's also the fact you're taking up a bed which could be available for someone who is more sick. So what should you do? And the answer is, feel what that person wants you to do. The way of meditation which gets you a little bit of telepathy, it's normal, it's not sort of supernatural. If it's someone you love and care for a lot, just make your mind very peaceful and listen to your heart. Usually the first thought which comes up is the correct one. You ask the question, make your mind still, listen. And then you'll know whether it's the right time to turn off the machine or to keep it running. That telepathy is very common between, you know, members of a family. It's so common that you may be sitting here in Singapore and maybe your daughter in New York has a car accident and you know. It happens so frequently. So if you can do that, can't you be by their bedside? They can't talk to you, but you can feel what they need to do. And then follow that fearlessly. If the thought comes into your mind, they're gone. Then turn off the machine. If the thought comes into your mind, I think there's still something there, keep it going. That's a practical way, and it's very effective.
Ajahn Brahm, can you explain how we should conduct Buddhist funerals? Because in Singapore, you can buy chanting, like one day for $1,000 and 3 days be $3,000. And how much chanting should we buy for our dead relatives?
There's an old story from the Buddhist suttas. He said a man threw in a clay pot full of oil into the water. And it broke as it hit the water. The clay pot sank to the bottom, the oil floated to the top. And the Buddha said, if like a monk or some priest went to the side of that water and started chanting all day and all night for the clay pot to rise and the oil to sink, do you think he could ever do it? In the same way, the Buddha said that most people, because of their karma, They go down or they stay up according to their karma, and all the chanting in the world doesn't help. Most times, the chanting can only help if they're just in between, to try and sort of bump them up a little bit. But you can't do much. And anyway, so all that chanting in the world is wasting so much money. Sometimes I think the Japanese have the right idea. In the crematoriums in Japan, they found it so expensive and also so difficult to find a monk to perform the funeral services that they have a robot monk. And all they do is put in the CD and it always chants perfectly. And apparently in the crematorium, because the Japanese, I don't know if it's a sense of humor or a sense of drama, but this monk is like this, a robot, and they chant perfectly the whole funeral service. And this is true. I read it in the magazine. At the end of the service, the monk, it's a machine, it actually levitates off the floor and actually goes in this dry ice clouds into a trapdoor in the ceiling at the end of the service. And it's very, very popular. And it's also much cheaper than paying thousands of dollars for monks. So perhaps there's an opportunity for any entrepreneur in Komeng San to have a robot monk. They're much easier to look after.
We have someone at the microphone. Would you like to ask a question, please? Keep it short, please. It's not turned on. Can we have the microphone turned on? Thank
Hello.
You.
Hello. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Good evening, Venerable Sir. I basically lead a 100-member-strong volunteer group in a primary school. Many I work with are from the Catholic community, but I'm neither a Buddhist, a Christian, let alone a Catholic. I work with a bunch of very calculative, career-minded and financially motivated people. How can I overcome them?
So you have calculated financial people, you want to overcome them?
No. Well, I'm basically chairing the committee. Right, and I work with the principal and the teachers, and it's a parent support group I'm chairing. So basically, when I'm chairing the committee, issues where it comes to money and helping the poor, the less well-to-do, not so academically strong pupils that I have to help, it boils very much down to dollars and cents sometimes. So okay, that's where I'm driving it.
Yeah, I understand what you mean. I think one needs, if someone is chairing that committee, one needs to remind what that committee is all about. In my monasteries, that I have to serve on the committees. And when I serve on the committees, I tell people it's the Buddhist comes before the society. What are we here for? Which is why that some years ago we got a letter from one of our supporters who donated $1,000 to our nuns' monastery. He wrote this letter. He was in Thailand. He'd lost all his money. He was desperate. Can he have his donation back? And I took that letter to our committee because I wanted to see how my committee had listened to the Dhamma over these years. And the committee were responsible. They said, actually, according to our constitution, we can't do this. It's already been donated. It's gone to the books. But, they said, this poor man's in trouble. In the end, they voted to send the money back to him. And I was so proud of my committee. People are more important than money, than things. What have we got a school there for, anyway? Is it to make money, or is it to teach kids? And what are we teaching them, anyway, if we don't teach them kindness and looking after one another? So I think we need to come back to why we had that school there in the first place, and why people are serving on a committee in a Buddhist fellowship. It's wonderful to call it a fellowship, not a temple. You know, the original meaning of a church was never the building. The church was the people who gathered together anywhere. Later on, the building took the name away from the people. A school is the people in the school, especially the children. That is the important thing, not so much the money. So when we go back to the principles behind the establishment of a school, what a church is, what a fellowship is, when the committee realise what they should be doing, they realise it's the tail wagging the dog. The money is there to serve the kids, not the kids the money. So we need to actually get our priorities right.
Thank you.
Thank
okay.
You. Okay. Yeah, I've got a question first. Can you be a Buddhist and not believe in reincarnation?
Can you? I saw this answer yesterday. Don't worry if you don't believe in reincarnation in this life, because you're winning your next one. But can you? Yes, you can be a Buddhist and not believe in reincarnation, but, well actually, perhaps no, the answer's no. You can be a Buddhist if you have an open mind. But saying I don't believe in reincarnation is actually taking an extreme. You believe that reincarnation cannot exist. And if that's your belief, then you should check it out and challenge it. Test it out. Because a lot of people in Western countries, they hold this strong belief there cannot be rebirth. And they haven't really thought it through. They haven't gathered the evidence. The evidence is there. You can find out for yourself. So at the very least, keep an open mind and say, I don't know, maybe there is rebirth, maybe there's not rebirth. Let's wait and see. But if you really want to find out, I said yesterday, how you can find out before you die. It's one of the problems with religion that sometimes you say, we've got the right religion. You follow us and you go to heaven. Follow the other mob and you go to hell. The trouble is you can't find out which teaching is true until it's too late. If you back the wrong horse, then you lose all your money. The point is with Buddhism, you can find out right now. You don't have to believe. You can find out, test out. Is reincarnation true or false? Test it out.
Susan, would you like to ask your question?
Hello, yes. Okay, I'll keep it very, very short. But first I want to clarify, I did not ask any question yesterday. And after the session, a lot of people walk up and ask me why I didn't ask. So I thought I owed them an obligation tonight to ask again. Okay, thank you for that. Actually, there's one very quick joke in relevance to what Ajahn Brahm said just now. So I tell it very quickly. In a class, there's this teacher who actually asked the class, say, if any boy or anyone smart enough to answer my this question, he will get $100. So he says, who do you think the most important person to have impact on our history for the whole of centuries to come? So one of them thinks, Bill Gates, after all, computerization, IT. The teacher said, no, no. Then another one, because it's in London, the place where Ajahn Brahm comes from, he says, oh, must be the head of the state, Queen Elizabeth. No, no. Then there was this small Jewish boy seated behind the classroom. He put up his hand, stretched right out. So very eager to answer. So the teacher, oh yes. He said, I know the answer. Jesus Christ. So the teacher said, oh, you're good. Okay, after the class, you come and claim your prize from me personally. So after class, he walked up. So the teacher said, here is your $100. But first tell me how you derive your answer. You all know the answer? This small Jewish boy says, Moses is Moses. Business is business. You don't catch the joke. Ajahn Brahm, you do.
Okay.
Susan, can we get to the question, please?
Yeah,
I will. Yeah. Okay, my next question is, in modern times, a lot of people, or rather it's a societal norm that we equate evil with urbanization. As what we say, like maybe prostitution, integrated resort and so on. So is it a necessary evil, and is there a way to overcome?
Okay, about evil. But there is no such thing as evil in Buddhism. There's only stupidity. I like the word stupidity more than evil, because evil is something which is you can't really fix. When you see that stupidity is a problem, we realize it's something we can fix by being more intelligent, investigating, thinking things out, being more perceptive and understanding what's really going on. People who do terrorist acts are not evil, they're stupid. People who commit adultery, they're not evil, they're stupid. There's no point to it at all. Why do you do that for? You're just creating more pain for yourself and other people. So it's stupidity is the problem, not evil.
But when they go to the city, they have to find employment, and if that's the only job available, they have to do something.
No, they can always come and work for the Buddhist Fellowship or Kong Ming San.
Thank you, Susan. Can we get to the next question?
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
Thank you, Angie. Thank you.
Good evening, Ajahn Brahm. Good evening, Angie. My question is, when we say that the Buddha is well gone, does he just simply vanish into thin air? Or is there any mental activity left?
Okay, when you say the Buddha is well gone, I've seen this on some Christians say that the Buddha is dead, Jesus lives. And they say that's the difference between our two religions. And I say, no! Because in the suttas, and all the monks here know this is true, it is said in the suttas by the Buddha that he who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. She who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. Can you see the Dhamma today? Yes! So you can also see the Buddha. So you can put on bumper stickers on your car, Buddha lives.
So does that mean that the Buddha is not non-existent in a nihilistic sense? As in, he does exist, but it's not in a non-nihilistic sense.
What it means is the Buddha is not really the person. That's why the Buddha kept on saying, don't worship me. Just worship the teachings. So in Buddhism, we don't have like the guru tradition. You don't worship the teacher. You worship what he teaches or what she teaches. Now there's a lot of difference there. Because what it means is, it doesn't really matter who the person is. You listen to what they're saying. You make a separation between the person and the teachings. So it's the teachings which are important. Actually, it doesn't really matter where it comes from. As long as they're good teachings, they work, then put them into practice. So sure, the person who we call the Buddha died, passed away from samsara a long time ago. But that, in this one sense, is not the real Buddha. That was just a person. The embodiment of his life will never disappear, which is the Dhamma. It's the same when sometimes your wife, your husband, a child might die. I say, look, the body has died, but the memory of that person will live with you forever. That can never be taken away from you. The experience, the time you've had together, the teachings, the inspiration, that will always be there. The Dhamma is always there. That is the real Buddha. That's why that keeps on living. The one who sees the Buddha sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees the Buddha. That's the most important.
Thank you.
Okay.
Ajahn Brahm, following to the question, there is one here which relates to it. Yes. Could you please explain the difference between an arahant and the Buddha? And is the arahant inferior to a Buddha?
Can you explain the difference between arahant and a Buddha? The Buddha was the first arahant in this sequence of time. That is the only difference, the temporal difference. So the attainment, the Buddha said, was the same. The Buddha had a few other little extras there, but they weren't really important. Just like the extras you have on a car, but they're not really important. It's the same model of car, but the Buddha is the first model of the production line. I hope that makes sense.
Okay.
But they're all the same models. But, you know, the Buddha actually did have a few extras, you know, the air con and the GPS system and all that sort of stuff. But basically the same model, but the Buddha was the first off the production line in this Buddha era, this cycle of production.
If that's the case, then the enlightenment level should be the same. But sometimes we hear, oh, he's enlightened and she's enlightened, but they seem to be different stages or different types of enlightenment.
Well, there are the stages of enlightenment of a stream, meaning once returning, non-returning, the arahat. But the full enlightenment, the arahats are the same.
Perhaps
one of the beautiful things about Buddhism, we don't have elitism. So, you know, all that elitism, I'm better than you, you're better than me, that's actually not really part of Dhamma. In the same way that in a school, can you actually say the children in grade one are inferior to, the children in the last year at school? You never say they're inferior. The children in grade one are just starting. Of course they don't know as much as the children who are about to go to university. It's the same in life. We've all started from different places. Some are just beginning. Some have been, you know, around samsara many times. But you don't say that they're better. The arahat isn't better than the stupid person at the bottom of the heap. Sometimes the arahat's been there a bit longer, that's all. So we don't judge one person's superior, the other person's inferior.
Could you explain a bit more about the different stages of enlightenment? Because some people feel, or they teach that even while you're washing dishes, you can be a sotapanna. That means you've realized first level of enlightenment.
Which would mean that all the maids in Singapore would be sotapannas by now.
You have this analogy of the sailors. Could you?
Okay, the stages. Yeah, the stages. It's a story from the Buddha scriptures of the seven shipwrecked sailors. The seven shipwrecked sailors, in brief, goes like this: the seven shipwrecked sailors in the middle of the ocean. The first one goes straight down. The second one goes up, goes down, goes up, goes down. The third one floats on top of the water, so they don't drown. The fourth one, floating on top of the water, sees dry land. The fifth one, he's seen dry land, he's swimming to the dry land, which is what you do when you see dry land. The sixth shipwrecked sailor, he's so close to dry land, he's actually standing in the surf, he's wading to the shore. And the seventh shipwrecked sailor, she's found the shore, she's safe, she's sitting under the coconut tree eating a bowl of noodles. Now what that means is the first shipwrecked sailor, a person who's done bad karma, they go down. The second shipwrecked sailor, they've done some good karma, some bad karma, you know, like the average person. Now they go up, now they go down. The third shipwrecked sailor is a good person. They've been kind, virtuous, generous. They always tend to keep their head above water in the difficulties of life. They never really drown under suffering because they're good people. Now, when you're a good person, you can become the fourth sailor. Because you've got your head above water, you can look around, you can actually see dry land. That's nibbana, safety. That's called the stream winner. You've figured out how to be safe. The next one, having figured it out, having seen through insight, dry land, nibbana, you're swimming towards dry land. That's when you really get into keeping precepts. You just don't want to harm any other being. It doesn't make sense to you, it's just harming yourself. And you're swimming, you're keeping your precepts, you're practicing meditation, you're getting very wise, you're on your way to shore. That's called the once returner. You get so close to shore, you can actually stand up, you don't need to swim anymore, you can wade to shore. That's called a non-returner. They're so close to enlightenment, it's hardly any difference. And the last one, the fully enlightened one, they're safe. They don't need to swim anymore. They're so happy, they're sitting under a coconut tree having their favourite bowl of noodles. Now that's a simile of the seven shipwrecked sailors, taught by the Buddha so that people could understand what enlightenment was, how it happens. First of all, you see what real happiness is, what nibbana is. Once you see it, then you start swimming for it. And once you reach nibbana, then you're the arahat. The bowl of noodles was not said by the Buddha. That's my addition.
Yes, because the noodles came from China.
talk to this guy from Italy.
Good evening, Ajahn Brahm. Thank you very much for your wonderful and meaningful talk tonight. In our daily life, we are facing up and down, and sometimes we face uncertainty, unfairness. My very simple question, basically, how to cultivate the practice of to let go? Thank you.
Okay, so how to practice to let go, especially with unfairness. One of the stories in my book I learned from one of my prisoner disciples. After teaching meditation for a while, he asked for a personal interview. So I talked with him in private, and he told me that the crime for which he'd been put in jail for, he did not commit. He was innocent, and he put in jail for something he didn't do. Straight away he said, I know that many prisoners would say this to you, and they're lying, but I am telling you the truth. He said, I would lie to others, but I would not lie to you, Ajahn Brahm. The way he said it convinced me he was telling the truth. He was telling the truth. He'd been put in jail, sentenced for something he didn't do. In most jails throughout the world, once you're in jail, you don't have much access to a phone, let alone to lawyers. So I thought, I'm a monk, I've got my contacts, I should act compassionately to seek justice for this poor man. And I started thinking of all the lawyers I knew, and I was going to contact them and right this injustice. This was unfair. An innocent man had been put in jail. When I was thinking like this, he smiled at me. And he said, but Ajahn Brahm, there are so many other crimes I did, and I wasn't caught. I guess this is fair. He taught me the law of karma. How many times is it we think it's unfair? Do you ever think it's unfair when you're speeding and you don't get caught? Do you ever think it's unfair when you don't declare all your income and you don't get caught? No, it's only unfair when we don't do something and we get caught. So actually, it all balances out in the end. Perhaps life is fair. If you look at all the stuff you got away with and all the times you were caught for something you didn't do, perhaps it is fair after all.
So if you got a ticket tonight for parking illegally, consider it fair, because you've probably done it other times, so you never got caught. Okay, I'll go on to the last question, because since it's a Sunday and tomorrow most of you will be working, but please, just because the last question, don't rush out, let's end this nicely so that we all get a good blessing. Oh, sorry, Uncle Poaching.
Excuse me, can I ask a question?
Two.
Right, this two. And the last question from my pal, and then that's it, okay? Uncle Poaching first?
No, let him first.
Oh,
let
right. Him. Young man.
I think you first.
Right, get on with it, one of you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Right, welcome.
The question I ask is not about Buddhism in modern time, but it's about the retreat center that your monastery is building. We have heard from Angie about it. We have read the handout about it, but they are all second-hand information. I would like to take this opportunity to hear from the master himself.
Okay.
Thank you.
There's lots of people here in Singapore who want to learn how to meditate. And even today at the Zen conference, there are people coming up to me and said, look, I want to meditate. Do I need a master? Do I need a teacher? Please help. I've heard that meditation is so wonderful. And it is wonderful. I got so much benefit out of meditation in my life. That's why I really want to teach it to other people. What I get, I want to share and give back. However, to teach meditation is very difficult. Sometimes you need the right situation. Already that people have been coming from Singapore and Malaysia to my center, in Western Australia. We have been holding meditation retreats outside of my monastery, because my monastery is jam-packed with monks. There's hardly any room at all. And these with young monks, 19, 20, 21 years of age, wanting to join the monastic order. That's why there's a great future for Buddhism, because my monk factory, we've got young products which are going to last a long time. sometimes in monasteries you only get second-hand products after they finish with their wife. The wife has used them first, we just get them second-hand. These are new products. But it's not just, we've been holding our retreats in a Catholic center, which is fine, but number one, we can't hold many retreats there because it's booked with other people. And number two, that, you know, it's not a very good situation for teaching meditation. It's noisy, it's in the middle of the city, it's the ambience is not really all that good. And so for a long time, some of my disciples said, Ajahn Brahm, why don't we build a meditation center in Perth? Western Australia is not that far away from Singapore. And also, we've got the wonderful thing in Australia, we've got space. Huge continent, very few people. And because of that, you know, we can get these huge tracts of land. You know, our nuns' monastery is 600 acres. There's only three nuns there. A lot of space for growth. And we've got this beautiful block of land, 140 acres. It's very peaceful forest, very scenic, very quiet. It's a perfect place for meditation retreat. And so having seen it, and many of you who've been to Australia, to my monastery, have seen that beautiful piece of land. It's such a great place for a retreat center. I decided, let's go and do it. And so we want to build a retreat center there. And my goal is that we can raise enough money in all these countries where I teach so that the retreat center will be priceless. So anyone can go and they won't be charged. They can leave a donation afterwards if they wish. If they can't afford it, that's fine. Because that's a beautiful Buddhist teachings. We're giving it for free. Even though the food is needed, maintenance is needed. Well, sometimes it's great to say, look, just because you're poor doesn't mean you can't go. And I also want to make it comfortable. Because some of the retreats which I've taught in Malaysia especially, and even here in Singapore, sometimes people are bunked up in rooms together and there's always someone snoring. So people are tired, and because they're tired they can't really benefit to the full extent from their meditation. Also, there are many people here with cancer who are old, who just can't sit on the floor for hours at a time. Why should they be denied the benefits of meditation? So I want to make it comfortable. Not just a meditation retreat center for young people just out of the national service, but for old people, sick people, anybody, so they can actually benefit from meditation and a beautiful, peaceful mind and the joy, the insights and all the other things which come from meditation. So having had that sort of that goal, I get nothing out of this personally. I just get more people to teach, that's all. And I don't want more people. Got enough already. But I want to do this because I think it's something which needs to be done. Compassionate action which will really help other people. So that's why I wanted to build this meditation retreat center and why I'm building it in that place. If there was lots of land, quiet places in Malaysia or Singapore, maybe we could build it there. But there's land in Malaysia, but it's, you know how hard it is with the government to actually to get permission to build anything which has got Buddhist by its, to its name. Australia is so close, so easy, so safe, so peaceful. That's why I want to build it there. So this is what we're doing.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
Hello, good evening, Ajahn Brahm. Interesting to hear that you say Buddhism is more of a form of a sign. There are actually three parts to my question. My first question is that how can you relate Buddhism to sign? Because sometimes sign can't explain everything. For example, like, you know, the ghost, how to use sign to explain about ghosts. Second part to my question is that, you know, in some religion, they try to advocate the power of our prayer. Like in this Christianity, in Christianity, you can read that in the Bibles, Jesus actually researched, they make the day from the, he bring the dead back from dead people back from the dead, and you can see that in the religion of Sai Baba. Sai Baba actually used his prayer to cure the sick people, and in some Japanese religion, they actually use prayer to cure some diseases. And the third part to my question is that I don't quite convince that if you are just, if somebody is going to pass away, how can you rely on sign in order to give you a sense of calmness, or in order to give you peace of mind? Thanks.
Okay, just the first question about signs and ghosts. I was telling somebody earlier today that when I was at Cambridge, I was also a member of the Psychic Research Society. They celebrated their 100th anniversary while I was there. I became very friendly with a man who eventually became the head ghost hunter of United Kingdom. His name was Tony Cornell. The last time I visited UK, I had lunch with him, with one of my old college friends. And he's a close friend. And he was the head ghost hunter. Even when I was at college, he would give me his business card, Tony Cornell, on the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And so he was the expert. Sometimes in Australia, I'd see newspapers with articles about hauntings in England. He would invariably be writing the articles. He was a scientist who didn't just say, there can't be ghosts, or I believe in ghosts. He said, let's find out. The evidence is there if anybody is willing to look it up. The trouble with people, I don't believe it, it can't exist. So they don't even bother to see the evidence. Evidence is there. Because the evidence is there, recorded by people who have got no vested interest in proving it one way or another, scientists who apply the scientific method to ghosts, that I say it's a scientific fact that such beings exist. That's what real science is. Look for the facts, investigate it, and if the facts say it is there, even if you believe it, it can't be there. You have to change your beliefs to fit the facts. It's number one. It is a scientific fact. The number two was about what? Question number two. You've forgotten too.
I'm retired.
Yeah, please.
Sorry. My second question is that, most of the religion, they try to promote the power of prayer.
Oh, that's right.
Okay, yeah. That happens in Buddhism as well. I spend a lot of time chanting for other people. And the reason I do that is because often it works. Oh, I just remember being in Penang once, and there was a person in coma. We chanted for them during the retreat, and the email came back an hour later, they'd come out of coma.
But how do you relate this to, let's say you compare Buddhism as a form of science?
In form of science, you do the research. You look and see what happens when you do things like prayer. If you really want to look at some scientific facts, you can actually look at a website, H-A-D-O, HADO. Google it this evening. You come across a website of a Japanese professor who's done his experiments with water. He's got his students to sit around a bowl of water, maybe 200 students, and to try their best to maintain one emotion in their mind for half an hour. An emotion may be anger. Think anger for half an hour, sitting around this bowl of water. Think it again and again and again, as much as you can. Sustain it, maintain it. And then he's slowly frozen that water and taken photographs of the crystals which form. He's tried other emotions, like gratitude, like piety, filial piety. Look at his website and you'll find something fantastic. You'll see that the different emotions create different forms of crystals. And you can judge for yourself, it is quite obvious. that when you surround some water with positive emotions, you get these amazingly beautiful crystals. If you have these negative emotions like anger, you get these ugly looking crystals. You can see for yourself that just students sitting around some water thinking kind thoughts or bad thoughts actually affects the water in a way which you can measure. He's measured that. Science says that you are 70% water. Imagine 200 people sitting around you thinking the thought, you make me sick. What will that do to your water? Imagine 200 people thinking, may you be happy and well, may you be free of all suffering and pain. What will that do to your water? There is some scientific evidence there. You can see it. I'm not just saying believe. Go back this evening. Very easy. H-A-D-O. Hado. Google it in. And you've got some scientific evidence there and the power of the mind to affect water. And you can understand how praying, chanting, loving kindness, spreading joy, how that affects people.
In fact, you don't have to Google it. You can get it from the Awareness Play Store out there. It's called The Hidden Messages in Water by Masaru Emoto.
There we go.
Power of Water. Hado, healing and discovering ourselves.
And he's not a Christian. I don't think he's a Buddhist. I don't know who he is. The point is that this is not confined to one religion. This is just nature. If you can empower your mind and sustain a thought of kindness to somebody, it affects other people. Now, even in the Buddhist scriptures, you know, the Buddha did some amazing things, healing people, but we downplay that because that's not the most important point of a religion. The most important point of the religion is the teachings. Okay, so you can bring a person to life, but they're going to die again. So, you know, what's the point there? Isn't it much more important, as the Buddha did, to Kisa Gotami's son? When Kisa Gotami had one son who had died, and she wanted the Buddha to bring him back to life again, the Buddha said, go and get the 3 mustard seeds from a house where no one has ever died. And so she went into the village full of hope, knocked on the first door, I want a mustard seed. Sure, but has anyone ever died here? Oh, I'm afraid so. Go to the next house. Has anyone died here? Yes. Anyone died here? Yes. This was a trick of the Buddha to make her understand that the death of her son was the only death in the world. Isn't it the case when someone close to you dies, you think that's the biggest thing in the whole world? It's as if the whole world has died when you're grieving. To understand that the death of your loved one is not alone in this world. The people are dying every day. When she understood that, she understood that death is part of life. It's inevitable. And even if the Buddha could bring her son back to life, eventually they'd have to part. What the Buddha gave her was something more important than the resurrection of her son. The Buddha gave her the knowledge of life and death. And Kisa Gotami went back, buried her child, thanked the Buddha, became a nun and became one of the great arahats, the great enlightened nuns at the time of the Buddha. The Buddha gave her something much more than the life of her son back. Gave her enlightenment, freedom, truth. That's why that, you know, these, we do the chanting, we can heal somebody, but I know they get sick again afterwards. This happened to me, that there was one person, disciple, they were dying in Perth. I went to do some chanting to try and get them better. It worked. They started getting better. And I got told off by the family. They said, look, we'd reconciled to the fact that our father is dying. Your chanting has delayed the process. Leave him alone. Let him go. So I had to stop chanting. And then the person died. But they were going to die anyway. My chanting was just actually keeping them going a bit longer. It was actually being quite cruel and mean.
Okay. I think let's get to the last question.
Part of it, wasn't it? The last part of it was the third part? What's the third part of the question?
Okay, you've got the answer. Very good. Thank you. So I think the last question that I think a lot of people new to Buddhism would ask, well, Buddhism teaches us to let go, but by letting go, does that mean we deprive ourselves of hard work and success?
No. You should, what you do when it's something to do, you give it everything you've got. When it's nothing to do, that's when you let go. So ask yourself, is there something I can do? If there is, give it everything you've got. When it's time to work, you really work hard. Look at me. Am I a lazy monk? I work really hard and I teach letting go. What I mean by that, when I'm in Singapore, I work so hard to teach, to serve. I'm going to go outside there afterwards. I'm going to be signing those books until my hand falls off. At least that's what it feels like. But then when I go back and have a rest, I completely forget about you. And I go into this beautiful deep sleep. I don't carry the past into my sleep. And I don't know what I'm going to do. Tomorrow morning I'm going to a TV interview or something.
Yes, for but your information, tomorrow is TV live interview on Channel News Asia at 9:20 a.m.
Okay.
So turn on your TV.
But at that time, or this evening, I'm not going to think, I'm going to go on TV tomorrow. What am I going to say? How is it going to work? You know what I'm really afraid of? I admit this. I'm afraid of having to go into the makeup room.
Sorry, we'll send you there late and there won't be time for any makeup.
No, but I'm not going to worry myself sick about these things. That's going to happen tomorrow. So it's a long time in the future. That's what we call like letting go. Not holding the past and worrying about the future over much. This is why I say whenever I come to Singapore, I don't take my monastery from Perth with me. When I leave tomorrow afternoon, I do not take the Buddhist Fellowship back into Australia. I leave it here. So what I mean is, that's what we mean by letting go. You don't carry so many burdens around with you. But when you're doing something, give it everything you've got. When it's time to rest, give resting everything you've got. You kids, when you're at school, give studying everything you've got. But when you go to a party, give partying everything you've got. When you're meditating, meditating everything you've got. This is actually how we live a full life. Okay.
Thank you very much, Jim Brown.
Tired out.
And as we always end, if we may dedicate our merits for having listened to a wonderful Dharma talk. And there is this lady who asked for some dedication to her uncle who's in coma. Can we do it without his name?
Yeah, sure.
Can I let you do the chanting and the blessing then, and in dedication to her uncle who is in coma?
Okay, this is...
Oh, there you go. Okay. Lo Chi Kyong. Lo Chi Kyong.
Lo Chi Kyong. I mean, this chanting, like I was saying, with the water, it actually works, because especially a monk who's been practicing meditation for so long, you do get powerful minds. Even though my body is tired, my mind is still very bright. And because of that, you can actually affect people. So I'm going to give a blessing for you and for all the other beings in this temple and in this area, but also for those people who are sick in the hospitals. And it's also for this person who is in a coma. And we're using my mind, I'm asking your mind to also wish happiness and well-being and recovery from illness of all beings who are sick. I'll do this chart now. Please use it to focus your mind on such good thoughts to affect all the water in Singapore. Sabaroga vinimuto sabasanta pavajito sabavera matigando Nibuto chatuang bawa sabitio viva chantu Sabaroko vinasatumate pavanvantarayo sukhiti kayugopava apivadhanhasilitsa nichangvata pacharino chataro dhamma vatanti Ayu wano sukang balang.